Well, it's a deep personal pleasure as well as institutional pleasure for me to be here to introduce Nadine Strossen to you all. She is, as you know, the president of the American Civil Liberties Union. You may not know she was the first woman to hold that position. She still, somehow, to my surprise, remains able to be a full-time professor at New York Law School, a prolific author, and one of the most constructive interlocutors in national debate about the most contentious issues. The National Law Journal has twice named her one of the most 100 influential lawyers in America, and this last fall, Ladies Home Journal included her as one of the 100 most important women in America. So we've transcended lawyers and into the general population. Her book, Defending Pornography, Free Speech, Sex, and the Fight for Women's Rights, was named by the New York Times a notable book of 1995. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. She is a graduate of this school, magna cum laude in 1975, and was an editor of the Law Review. Last fall, when I was doing some research on hate crimes, I found very valuable work by Nadine Strossen. And yesterday, when I was doing work on the effect of hospital mergers on reproductive freedom, I found very valuable work by Nadine Strossen. In short, any subject of importance to contemporary American politics and law, you will find something important and valuable by Nadine Strossen. So I'm very delighted she's here with us today.
Thank you so much, Martha, for that gracious introduction, and I'm really delighted to be here and to see such a good turnout on such a balmy spring day. I was going to start by saying I used to love coming to these forum events when I was a student, and I really did, but I was about to say before that, I think if I were you, I'd probably be out jogging by the Charles, but I'm really very, very happy to be here, and I did partake of Harvard Law School Forum's events a lot when I was a student. Preparing for my remarks today, I went back and reread the brochure that the forum has put together, and it refreshed my recollection about the history. I'm not sure all of you have refreshed recollection, so let me just tell you that it was created by World War II soldiers who were returning to Harvard Law School as a memorial to their fellow students who had sacrificed their lives in the war. I put myself, by the way, in your position, oddly, although it was 25 years ago that I graduated, it seems to me as if it was just yesterday, and that's a warning, but time is going to fly. At least it's going to fly if you have fun, and I assure you, if you get involved in civil liberties work with your law degree, you will have fun, and the time will fly. But I put myself back in your position, and I was thinking, what would I have wanted to hear when I was a student? And I thought it should be a combination of personal remarks and professional remarks and substantive comments on the law with a maximum amount of time for your questions and comments. So reflecting on the origins of this important organization, the Harvard Law School Forum, soldiers returning from World War II, made me want to share with you the fact that my father was born in Germany in 1922. He was what the Nazis called a half-Jew or a Jew of a half degree, and which were treated, by the way, exactly the same way as other Jews were treated. He was put in a concentration camp where he almost died. He was liberated by American soldiers and came to this country as a refugee after the war. For the rest of his life, which unfortunately ended last year, but for the rest of his life, he continued to feel and to convey toward me his undying gratitude for the American soldiers who had given him freedom in the most literal sense of the word. And he also continued to feel an undying gratitude for the freedom in the more general sense that this country afforded, in a way that, of course, Nazi Germany was the antithesis of that. So with that kind of background, you can understand how moved I was to refresh my recollection as to the precise origins of the Harvard Law School Forum. And I was also very moved by a fact that I know I did not know until I read the brochure again yesterday, that the Forum's very first program, which was almost exactly 54 years ago, was about the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. I don't know if you knew that, Martha. And it was on March 8, 1946, so it will literally be the 54th anniversary of the Forum tomorrow. Well, with what I've told you about my background, you can already understand, I think, why I'm so honored and excited and privileged to be doing what I am doing, heading the nation's oldest and largest civil liberties organization. I did go to law school with the hope of making a positive change on my community and on the law. And for those of us who entered law school in the early 1970s, there were quite a few of us who had those aspirations. Actually, even then, at the height of the student activist movement, we were still a small minority. And I know in today's terms, it sometimes sounds very idealistic and very ambitious to talk about having these goals of using our wonderful legal educations and the incredible doors and opportunities that it will open to make a positive change on the law. I remember a lecture you gave quite a few years ago, Martha, in which you talked about how students were, in those days at least, embarrassed about using the J word, justice. I hope that's not still true. And I can say absolutely unabashedly that my experience in using my law degree and working with people all over the country who are using theirs has absolutely exceeded even the grandest ambitions and ideals that I had when I was sitting here as a student a quarter of a century ago. And I say that not at all to pat myself on the back, but to pat on the back the legal system. You know, it's quite interesting. Many years ago now, when I had only been practicing law half as long as I have now, a journalist asked me a very interesting question. Every once in a while, they get you to think about things that you haven't thought about before. And the question was, now that you've practiced law for 15 years or so, do you have a more positive or more negative or just the same view you had toward the system of justice when you were a student? And it only took me, you know, a few seconds to realize that my impression of the legal system was far more positive as a result of my involvement and engagement with it, and what I have been able to achieve not only on behalf of my clients but also on behalf of larger causes far exceeded even the great hopes I had had as a student. A lot of credit for the joy I've derived from my profession has also come from the wonderful other lawyers I've worked with, including many people who are my classmates at Harvard Law School. I was reminiscing with John on the way over here that one of my classmates in law school and college, for that matter, is somebody named Jamie Gorelli, who I know has spoken here. She was second in command at the Justice Department recently, and we're constantly debating each other in the most friendly ways, but during the days when the ACLU was suing Janet Reno in a case that I'm sure you've all heard of, it ultimately was decided by the Supreme Court 9-0, ACLU versus Reno, striking down the Congress's first attempt to censor the Internet. And there were many other conflicts between the ACLU and the Justice Department, but Jamie was enjoying what she was doing in pursuit of her sense of justice as much as I am and did enjoy what I was doing. So I think, you know, from a personal point of view, slash professional point of view, I really want to encourage all of you to take the opportunities that you will be given as a result of getting this prestigious degree and the wonderful education that lies behind it, and use it to advance your sense of justice, whatever that might be. And I truly am not making a pitch for all of you to run out and become volunteer ACLU lawyers, although I would certainly love it if you did, and we certainly have more cases, unfortunately, that are worthy than we have lawyers who are able to handle them. But I sincerely mean that even if you would have ideas that are completely opposed on a particular issue, go to the organization or the agency that will allow you to pursue that sense of justice. And I say this because I meet and I have colleagues in the teaching world and in the practicing world who are constantly meeting lawyers, including young lawyers, who are so unhappy, who are so frustrated, who are so bored with the practice of law, who are dropping out of the profession. A study was recently done by the Association of the Bar of the City of New York on women in the profession, and it found that women were joining law firms in the same numbers and percentages that men were, but dropping out extremely quickly because of frustrations that this is just not a satisfying career, it's not fulfilling, it's not enabling us to have a sense of excitement intellectually and politically and the sense of engagement that we hoped for when we went to law school. But I constantly also meet, through my work with the ACLU and with other organizations, lawyers who love what we do, who can't get enough of it, who do it for free, who would probably pay to do it if we couldn't be accepted as volunteers. And I say that is also a non-ideological point because I've made friends who love what they're doing who are on the other side of cases from us. And in fact, the reason that they are friends, I think, is because what we have in common with each other is far more important than what separates us. What we have in common is a commitment to use our skills and talents and education to advance our view of the common good, of justice, whatever that might be. And unfortunately, in an era where most of our fellow citizens aren't even voting, let alone getting more engaged in political or public issues, the fact that we share that common commitment to public issues, even though we may radically disagree about what the outcome should be on particular issues, binds us together. I thought, in honor of Women's History Month, which it is now, that I would like to give you one concrete example of how law has really made an enormous difference even within my professional lifetime. And I say this not at all to say we should rest on our laurels, look at all the progress we've made toward achieving social justice and civil liberties, but for exactly the opposite reason. I already told you, we have, just speaking from the ACLU's perspective, and we are the largest and oldest, but we're certainly not the only civil liberties organization in the country. But just from our perspective, we have far more worthy cases than we have lawyers who are able to handle them. So this is the giving you a little bit of history as to how much has been accomplished. It's only for purposes of encouraging you that far more that still needs to be accomplished also can be done and that you can make a significant contribution to it. Women's History Month, the two, I think, overriding issues from my perspective in women's rights are, number one, just equality of opportunity, equality of treatment under the law. That wonderful statement over the Supreme Court's entrance, for those of you who have seen it, equal justice under the law. When I was starting my education here at Harvard, my higher education, the United States Supreme Court had never once accepted the argument, which had been made by the ACLU and others, that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause had anything whatsoever to do with gender discrimination. In fact, in a case that the Supreme Court lost in the Supreme Court in the early 1960s, actually, I have to correct that, the ACLU never loses a case in the United States Supreme Court. I'm very proud to report we've got wonderful lawyers, we've got truth and justice on our side. It's just that, unfortunately, sometimes the judges make mistakes. So a mistake was made in the early 1960s in a case in which the court said that the Equal Protection Clause had absolutely no impact on a Florida law that excluded women from serving on juries. Well, it was at about that time that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her capacity as a law professor, was teaching some of the first courses, doing some of the early writing from an academic point of view, challenging the long history of exclusion of women from constitutional protection under the 14th Amendment. And when she decided that she wanted to craft a targeted strategic litigation program to start to implement some of those academic theories, I'm very proud that she chose the ACLU as the vehicle for her activism. She became the founding director of the Women's Rights Project of the ACLU for a couple of reasons. One, because of the excellent lawyering and the great reputation our lawyers had and continue to have. The other reason was because we have this nationwide network of grassroots organizations in every state. We call them our affiliates and our chapters. And through that structure, she was able to identify particularly sympathetic cases with particularly compelling facts that could be marshaled in some kind of strategic order before the court to get it to gradually reexamine and overturn those past precedents. And progress was made in the early 70s, as those of you who have studied this know. We never did get the fifth vote for the position we were arguing, that gender-based classifications should be as presumptively unconstitutional as race-based classifications. The closest the court came to that position was in a case that Ruth argued for the ACLU in 1973. We got four votes for that position, and then the law stayed the same until, as you know, 1997, when the long missing fifth vote was finally cast from the other side of the Supreme Court bench by Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself. I still get chills when I think of it, and obviously attaining formal legal equality is only the first step, as we know. We only need to look at the long, sad history of de facto and de jure, or de facto discrimination and segregation and deprivation of voting rights on the part of African Americans. But it was an enormously important step. The other major change I see in the law in the same time frame has to do with the other, to me, core foundation of women's rights, and that is women's reproductive freedom. The early advocates of women's equality early in the last century, I have to say now, as well as those who revived the women's movement in the 1960s, had as a primary tenet reproductive freedom. Margaret Sanger, Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself, among others, said, "Women cannot be truly free and equal until or unless we have control over our reproductive functions." And when I was a law student, Roe versus Wade had not been decided. Abortion was completely illegal all over this country. And in fact, when I started college here in Boston, there was a prosecution going on of a doctor merely for having performed an abortion for health-related purposes, and he was being prosecuted because the bona fides of the health justification, which was a narrow exception to the Massachusetts criminal prohibition, he was being criminally prosecuted. And I will never forget sitting in what used to be this room, was this Lando North, sitting in this room in my torts class, and somebody running down the stairs January 21st, I think, something like that, 1973, the beginning of that semester, saying the Supreme Court has just struck down laws prohibiting abortions. You can't imagine, I think for those of you who grew up taking that precious freedom for granted, you just cannot imagine the excitement that caused. Again, this is a wonderful example, or a tragic example, I tend to have the positive viewpoint, of how, to quote the prime founder of the ACLU, Roger Baldwin, "No fight for civil liberties ever stays won." We have the largest squad we've ever had of lawyers who are working on reproductive freedom every single day. It is constantly under siege, especially if you are poor, especially if you are young, especially if you live far away from abortion providers. And I think Roe versus Wade itself is going to be up for grabs yet again in a couple of cases the Supreme Court has agreed to hear this term involving so-called partial birth abortion, which, if you are at all familiar with the statutes and with the cases, you will know these are bans not only on a particular procedure, not only during a certain period of pregnancy, but literally outlaw or threaten to outlaw, to the point of scaring away those few doctors who still do perform abortions anyway from performing even the most common abortion procedures completely throughout pregnancy. So again, you know, winning the legal right is a crucial step along the way, but that doesn't mean we fold our tents and go home. That means we push on to new frontiers, as well as refighting the old fights. I thought that I would give you a little bit of a background about what the ACLU does. I don't take it for granted that everybody knows about that, and then talk about just a few of the current hot issues, which it's impossible to choose. We have such a broad agenda. But the basic thing that I wanted to accomplish, and why I asked John and others associated with the forum to build this as a conversation, is to give you enough of a lay of the landscape of what it is that we are involved in so that you can then feel free to ask questions or raise comments or criticism, all are welcome about any particular aspect of the very broad agenda that we are pursuing. If I have to sum up the ACLU in one phrase, which I often have to do for reporters who are getting more and more fond of the soundbite, to me the fullest description is to say that we defend all fundamental freedoms for everyone. As such, that is a unique mission. All the other civil rights and civil liberties organizations in this country are, and this is not disparaging, I belong to and support every single one of them. They all perform a very important function. But we each have our unique niches. And the other organizations will be defined either in terms of particular rights. There are many organizations, for example, that are dedicated to freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, so forth, or to the rights of particular groups of people, people accused of crime, women, racial minorities, religious minorities. We are the only organization that sets, as a sometimes very challenging and daunting task, the task that government institutions, including the courts in our country, should follow, and that is not to automatically privilege one right, especially when it comes into conflict with others, as we sometimes see, not to automatically privilege the rights of a particular group of people, especially if it comes into conflict with others, as we also often see, but to do the best to fully defend and extend all fundamental rights for all people. We're staunchly nonpartisan, so that means it doesn't matter. It not only does it not matter who you are, it also doesn't matter what you believe. And that has often led us to situations where we are defending freedom for and rights of even individuals who are attacking other people's rights or using their free speech to advocate for suppression of rights. Tomorrow I'm going to be speaking at Southern Illinois University Law School, which is very upset because probably the most famous or infamous graduate ever of that law school is a fellow named Matthew Hale. Have you all heard of him? He's the whatever the equivalent of the Grand Dragon would be, there's some highfalutin term, of the World Church of the Creator, which really does believe in racial supremacy of whites to the extent of eliminating through war the lives of other members of what he calls the mud races, which include Jews and African Americans and, you know, basically just about everybody else in the population who doesn't have a, including some with white skin, so I'm not exactly sure what the definition is. But our view is that he should have the freedom to advocate those points of view, even though we would then thunderously raise our own voices to argue against his point of view, and more importantly, to prevent it ever being implemented through public policy in this country. To use another current example, all of the police brutality incidents and police misconduct and corruption that we've seen in New York and Los Angeles. In New York, the New York Civil Liberties Union has had a running battle with Rudy Giuliani, in fact, the police department forever, because of horrible and as almost always racially discriminatory instances of violence. I know the Amadou Diallo case got a tremendous amount of national publicity. The ACLU had taken out a series of ads in the New York Times. You're not going to be able to see it from here, but you get the basic idea. This is a full page, if you can imagine, very graphic. It's got the 41 bullet holes, which, as you know, were shot at this unarmed, dark-skinned man standing in his own apartment building. And under it, if we're combining several civil liberties issues here, we have the words of the Miranda warning, which, as you may know, is also under siege, having been found no longer to be in effect in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be ruling on it. But under each bullet hole is a word, you have the right to remain silent, etc., spelling out the whole warning. I, again, still get chills when I see this. And it says, on February 4th, 1999, the NYPD gave Amadou Diallo the right to remain silent, and they did it without ever saying a word, firing 41 bullets in 8 seconds. So So we're very concerned about this. Was, by the way, this ad, I welcome criticism. This ad was criticized by some as saying, aren't you prejudging the guilt of those police officers? Aren't you denying them their constitutional presumption of innocence, which was certainly not at all the intent. We were using this particular case to raise the larger concern about police brutality and misconduct, and not to say that they acted with the requisite intent for them to have been found criminally culpable, which was the issue in the trial. But even if it was, quote, just a mistake, just negligence, just recklessness, quote, unquote, this was a terrible tragedy, and it was one that had racially discriminatory implications as well. But we are concerned about the rights of police officers, as well as those whose rights are too often infringed by police officers. And one thing that I've had to say recently, including in a TV show with the Reverend Jesse Jackson last Thursday night, he was quite shocked. He and others have been calling for a criminal prosecution by the at the federal level of the police officers who were acquitted in the state prosecution in the Diallo case. And our view is that this violates a quaint provision in the Fifth Amendment called, you know, the prohibition against double jeopardy, being twice prosecuted for the same crime. Those of you who have studied criminal procedure may know that years ago, in the context of the first form of prohibition against alcohol at the beginning of the 20th century, the United States Supreme Court, in carrying out that war on those substances, created a legal fiction of dual sovereignty, that you can be prosecuted by separate sovereigns, even for the exact same crime, and the state and the federal government are two separate sovereigns. We oppose that exception. We always have opposed that exception, and we will continue to oppose it, even when that means it is letting off the hook police officers that many of us feel did, in fact, violate somebody else's rights. Well, not only do we defend the rights of everyone, regardless of who they are and what they believe, even if they're anti-civil libertarian, but we also try to defend all rights and all fundamental rights. This is sometimes very hard. How do you define what is a fundamental right? After all, what is one person's cherished fundamental right will be somebody else's abhorred antisocial crime. Abortion is a prime example there. Physician-assisted suicide, another prime example. I know Stephen Reinhart spoke at one of your programs last week, and I believe that's what he spoke about. And even if it is a fundamental right, what limits, if any, may government justifiably impose on those rights? After all, not even the most rabid civil libertarian says that any right is absolutely absolute. And what do we do? As I alluded earlier, we're more and more seeing situations where there are conflicts between rights or tensions between rights. In the age of the internet, for example, the ACLU, I'm proud to say, has been in the forefront litigating not only Reno versus the ACLU, but many other censorship and privacy issues online. Often there is a bit of a tension there. Eugene Volokh, who is speaking at another program at Harvard Law School this weekend, has written a very provocative article. It's going to come out, or has just come out, in the Stanford Law Review, in which he argues that the kind of legislation that the ACLU and other cyber libertarians are arguing for, that would allow individuals to take control over our data. Indeed, if you look at our website, we've had a campaign for years now called the Take Back Your Data campaign, insisting on legislation that would say that nobody may gain access to any information about us without honoring certain basic fair information practices, notifying us and giving us an opportunity to consent or not consent specifically to every aspect of how that information is used, for what purposes, to whom it may be given, how long it may be maintained. And this is an area where we find, by the way, one of the relatively few areas where public opinion is very much in favor of the civil liberties perspective. Something like 80% of Americans are appalled to learn that current law does not give them that kind of protection, and that even data about highly personal subjects such as medical and health information or financial information, in fact, is not subject to any of those basic fair information practices. And we've all heard many of the horror stories that occasionally get publicized about companies, the CVS pharmacy, for example, distributing information about what customers had bought in terms of their prescriptions and the underlying health situations, marketing them quite freely and prolifically. So there is that very, very serious privacy concern, but Eugene has argued, and I think with some plausibility, it requires analysis and response, that those kinds of restrictions raise free speech concerns because they are limitations on the collection and dissemination of data that would be inconsistent with, for example, the Freedom of Information Act and its state counterpart. So those of us in the ACLU have to do, again, what government officials have to do, and that is to try our best to maximally protect all of the competing rights in any particular circumstance, and without having, you know, a tilt necessarily one way or the other, I think even if we might get it wrong in a particular case, that at least there is an underlying principle that is driving the analysis rather than result orientation, and that is why we have a lot of credibility in the courts and the legislatures. They know that we are at least intellectually honest, and one of my favorite letters in this vein was from a gentleman with whom I was on a panel. In fact, we were debating the double jeopardy issue. This was shortly after the Rodney King incident, where, as you recall, there was a second civil rights prosecution by the federal government, and even though the ACLU in Southern California was the bane of the existence of the Los Angeles Police Department and leading the charge for vindication of Rodney King, we opposed the re-prosecution. So I was on this panel, and the gentleman in question wrote me a letter afterwards in which he said, I've quoted it so many times with his permission, I remember it. He said, "Dear Nadine, you strive to," this was somebody who had to put a little tweak in there. He said, "You do strive to be ideologically neutral and consistent in your open paren, sometimes misguided close paren application of principles. I'm sure I do admire you for that. I'm sure it sometimes comes at great cost organizationally and personally. Sincerely, Nino," and I'm talking about Antonin Scalia, of course. And so there is, and I can translate what I'm saying now into a personal lesson for all of you in your professional careers, regardless of what you do. Your integrity and your intellectual honesty is absolutely your most valuable intellectual asset. You absolutely have to allow those before you whom you are advocating to know that you are calling the shots honestly. You may get them wrong, but if they ever catch you out in trying to bend something, to twist it, to distort it, to exaggerate it, to suit the particular acts that you were grinding in on behalf of a lawyer, on behalf of a client, it is absolutely devastating. I can't tell you. And conversely, as long as you are intellectually honest and give the relevant authorities, including those that are adverse to your particular cause, in the long run, that is the most important contribution you can make toward any of your clients and toward any of the cases that you have. I only wanted to talk for a short time, John. I've already gone on for 30 minutes. Let me give you just a couple of examples of some of the hot issues that we're working on right now. It's very, very hard to choose because, as I've told you, we have this incredibly broad agenda. It literally goes from A to Z, or to use particular examples from the alphabet, abortion, which I've already mentioned, and affirmative action in the A's, to zero tolerance and zoning in the Z's, and everything in between. They're all under assault. We're working constantly on every front. If I have to choose one single issue above the others, and journalists are often forcing me to do this, going back to the soundbite again, I unhesitatingly take one. And that may surprise you because I've said they're all important, all these substantive issues. But I'm talking about one meta issue, so to speak. And here in a room full of lawyers, I'll use the abstract terminology, which I wouldn't use on TV or talk radio, and that is the independence of the judiciary. The ability of, in the federal system, the Article III judges with their relative insulation from the political process to honestly and consistently enforce the Constitution, and in fact to do what we in the ACLU try to do, but from a position of power and decision-making authority. You know, from having studied constitutional law, and perhaps some of you have studied federal courts as well, that the theory of Article III of the Constitution was that the federal courts, by being somewhat removed from the majoritarian political processes, would be able to provide a safety net so that when, you know, the tides of public opinion or often public panic, often political hysteria, would drive politicians to abandon fundamental rights, to abandon unpopular or powerless minorities, at least the courts would be there as a safety net. That was true in the civil rights movement in the South. Some of my greatest heroes are the federal judges in the South who dared to stand up to what the Supreme Court had said in Brown versus Board of Education, really were risking certainly their social well-being in the community and in some cases even their lives and safety by neutrally enforcing the Constitution. And in somewhat less dramatic circumstances, I see that every day in the work of the ACLU. Let me give you an example that many students are interested in our internet work as well. You should be. It's obviously the medium of the present and of the future. And we are constantly fighting political efforts to shut it down, to stifle it, to, you know, at least to turn it into the vast wasteland. I don't know how many of you have heard that famous phrase and know that it was coined by Martha Minow's father, Newt Minow, when he was chair of the FCC under the Johnson administration. But, I mean, at the very least, what we face is seeing the internet being turned into another vast wasteland like TV. At the worst, we can see it turned into some kind of government-controlled, monitored medium, as we're certainly seeing in other countries. And the laws that have been passed by enormous majorities on both sides of the political aisle, supported enthusiastically by the Clinton administration and at the state level by state governors all around the country. The Communications Decency Act, the CDA, the first one, was set a pattern that continues to this day. Out of 535 members of Congress, only 21 voted against it. And even that is somewhat of an overstatement because the 21 included members of the Women's Caucus who voted against it only because of a separate provision that expressly banned information about abortion. I debated Pat Schroeder, for example, when she was in Congress, and she wholeheartedly supported the central censorial provisions that would have outlawed anything that was patently offensive or indecent, which, by the way, I hated to shock her, but in many communities, information about abortion is considered patently offensive and indecent, along with much other serious expression, including anything to do with lesbian and gay sexuality or feminism. The United States Supreme Court, as you know, in 1997, essentially unanimously struck down that law. Tiny caveats in a dissenting opinion joined by two justices, but just a tiny, tiny exception. For the vast, vast majority of the law, they unanimously agreed that it was unconstitutional. And as I like to say to my law students, and as those of you who follow the Supreme Court know, it's very unusual for this court, which is so fractionated, to decide anything in the constitutional area unanimously. It's usually 5-4, or 3-2-1, with partial dissents and partial concurrences. So if they decide that something is unconstitutional unanimously, it is really, really unconstitutional. But that did not stop Congress, A, from passing it, B, from immediately going back to the drawing boards to pass the successor law, which we've now successfully challenged in the lower federal court. It was argued in appeal in the Third Circuit in November. Based on the comments that the judges made during oral arguments, I predict that this one, too, is going to bite the dust all the way to the Supreme Court. But again, you look at what's happening in Congress. Now, many members of Congress said, when we were lobbying against this law, many said it privately, quite a few even said it publicly, I know this law is unconstitutional. I know this law is unwise. I know this law is ineffective, stupid, dangerous, all the adjectives we were using, but I dare not vote against it for fear of being accused of being soft on porn. And when we won the lawsuit, I happened to be in Congress lobbying on something else the day the Supreme Court decision came down. Again, I can't tell you how many members of Congress said, congratulations, that was such a terrible law. You know, people who voted for it and who then proceeded to vote for the next one. The next one is called the Child Online Protection Act. I mean, who is going to vote against the Child Online Protection Act? Another example, we've challenged now not only CDA and COPA, the Child Online Protection Act, but about 8 different laws altogether, including state laws that are just clones of the CDA, completely wasting taxpayers' money. We have won every single one of those lawsuits. They have been ruled on by 24 different judges, completely across the ideological spectrum. These are judges that were appointed by every single president going back to Richard Nixon. If you do the count, that's 4 Republicans and 2 Democrats. And every single judge has voted with us in every single one of these cases. So the disparity that we're seeing on this incredibly important civil liberties issue is not between Republicans and Democrats, not between liberals and conservatives, but between judges, unelected judges who are accountable to the Constitution on the one hand, and elected politicians on the other hand. And I don't mean to, you know, I don't believe in guilt by association, of course. There are brave and courageous individuals who are still running for office and standing on principle, but they are relatively few and far between, and I continue to be so positively impressed and inspired by judges who transcend their own biases, their own backgrounds, their own political mentors, if you will, to do what they think the Constitution commands. And another example of an issue where this is, you see exactly the same disparity, is the partial birth abortion bans that I mentioned earlier. Almost without exception, these bans have been passed by huge majorities in the state legislature and Congress. As we know, President Clinton has vetoed the bans a couple of times, but there's still super majorities in both houses that support them. And yet, almost without exception, they have been struck down by almost every single federal judge who has ruled on them. So the independence of the judiciary is not just an abstract idea. It is something that makes a real concrete difference to rights that are incredibly embattled. And there have been persistent attacks on judges. We've recently seen calls for impeachment of judges who issue decisions that are politically unpopular. Of course, you know, the running battles between the administration and the Senate, although I'm not taking a stance. This is also nonpartisan. The administration, to me, has been very disappointing in not bringing forward judges that are seen to have political judicial candidates that are seen to have unpopular positions. Lately, somebody got shot down in the Senate because he was, of course, pro-death penalty. I mean, Clinton would not nominate anybody who dared to voice opposition to the death penalty. But this judge was deemed not sufficiently rapidly foaming at the mouth, you know, pro-death penalty. So he got shot down in the Senate. And there have been repeated hearings over the last couple of years for legislation that would cut back on the independence of federal judges, including a law that came out of a book that Robert Bork wrote a few years ago. It would have to amend the Constitution, but it's being very seriously considered by some in Congress to allow Congress, by majority vote, to overturn any decision by any court anywhere in this country. So, you know, if I were to pick one or two other issues, and I will literally just mention them because I want to open this up to questions, I really, really do. The whole constellation of issues that has to do with criminal justice, and boy, is that an oxymoron, the criminal injustice system and race discrimination and racial profiling and over-incarceration and the incredible discrimination and denial of due process and denial of basic human rights through the death penalty in this country and the war on drugs. They're all interrelated. One of our great successes in the public and litigation and lobbying sphere lately has been our campaign against racial profiling, the so-called crime of DWB, driving while black or brown. Again, an ad that we took out, you're not going to be able to see it from here, but I'll describe it. It's the exact same person, one with white skin, one with black skin, and it says, which man looks guilty? And we now have undeniable evidence and confession from law enforcement authorities all over the country that this is, in fact, what they are doing, and stopping and harassing people selectively on the basis of their skin color. And that kind of discrimination persists throughout the criminal injustice system, including who is incarcerated and who ultimately gets the death penalty. And we cannot do anything to it. Court is going to be especially vigilant to protect the rights of discrete and insular minorities because they cannot be protected by the majoritarian political branches of government. As I just said, I see that the truth of that every day. Well, by definition, dark-skinned people are racial minorities in this country. Unfortunately, the problem is being compounded because as you have an incarceration of now, it's something like one-third of all African-American men between the ages of 20 and 30 are in the thrall of the criminal justice system. To compound the problem, 40% of them are going to be permanently disenfranchised under state laws that take away the vote if you have ever served, been convicted of a felony, even after you've completely served your time. So not only are they not participating in the political process when they're incarcerated, they're being permanently removed from having any impact on the political process. The last issue I'll just mention is the demonization of high school students and teenagers in this country, which really had been bad enough but became even worse in the wake of Columbine. We have seen schools turned into fortresses and prisons, students turned into prisoners, and we are now going to court constantly on behalf of middle-class parents, our kids who have been A students, model students, who have never been in trouble before, but just because they are doing something different, literally. I mean, we have had to go to court, kids being accused of being terrorists if they have a hair color the school doesn't like, if they wear an earring or a tattoo or a t-shirt. What some of these school officials are very imaginative when they see gang symbols. We had to defend a Jewish student's right to wear the Star of David pin in Mississippi because his school board decided that was a gang symbol. Now, you know, I'm partially Jewish myself, so I can say it's a gang of sorts, but it's not that kind of a gang. And we actually had a case in Utah where a student was expelled for wearing a t-shirt that said vegan. Again, the judge said that is a dangerous gang. I hate to tell you this, I told you we never lose a case, but this is sure one where the judge made a mistake. The judge, and this t-shirt incident happened before Columbine. The decision came out right afterwards, and the judge actually somehow managed to link it up. He said, in this era with this epidemic of dangerous violence, and believe me, I certainly don't mean to trivialize it, although the good news is that it is not an epidemic. Those incidents, horrible as they are, distressing as they are a tiny minority. Sadly, students continue to be much safer in schools than any place else, including their own homes. But somehow he said, in this emergency atmosphere, this is a dangerous gang symbol, and the student is going to either not wear it or not be in school. And I guess that gives me a good note on which to end, because it was Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, hardly a radical civil libertarian, appointed to the court by Ronald Reagan, hardly a radical civil libertarian, who dissented in the last students' rights case that we had before the court, the last mistake the court made in that area. And O'Connor dissented, which is very interesting. If Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is saying students in schools are not having enough, in this case it was Fourth Amendment rights against drug testing, That means the rest of the court is pretty much off the deep end from my point of view. We're not talking about a Justice Brennan dissent, after all. And she said it can never, this was the opening salvo in her dissent, it can never be too often repeated that constitutional rights are most endangered in times of crisis. And I would simply add to that, or times of perceived crisis. And that is why the so-called war on drugs, the so-called war on terrorism, the so-called war on, you know, students in high schools, is these kinds of siege mentalities are really endangering all of our rights. And now I really, really will shut up so that you can exercise your free speech rights. I welcome your questions, comments, interventions of all sorts. Thank you.
I'm a freshman from college.
Oh, welcome.
As an 18-year-old, one question I've always wondered.
When did you turn 18?
When did I turn 18?
Yeah.
About a year ago.
Oh.
But one question I
was curious because a lot of these laws apply to anybody who is under 18. So in the CBA case, for example, in our brief, we pointed out that 123 college freshmen were subject to the law.
I've always wondered on what basis companies, especially the government, can discriminate based on age or factors, because the 14th Amendment, as you pointed out earlier, definitely does have an equal protection law. But why doesn't it necessarily apply to age? Because that would be your drinking age and the right to gamble in these states where it's illegal.
What the Supreme Court has done in interpreting / misinterpreting the Equal Protection Clause is basically to say the government may draw classifications, it has to draw classifications every day, all such classifications are going to be presumed unconstitutional and will be subject to challenge only if you can show that it serves no rational basis. There's no rational basis for the law, and there's no rational connection. There's no legitimate basis for the law, and there's no rational connection between the asserted basis. It's called a rational basis review, which is pretty much means the courts will rubber stamp. It's very hard to overcome that presumption of constitutionality. The court has said, though, with respect to certain kinds of classifications, we're going to have the opposite presumption, that they're presumed unconstitutional, and then the government has the burden of showing not only a legitimate purpose, but a purpose of compelling importance, and the harder part of the test is to show that this restriction, this classification is necessary in order to promote that purpose of compelling importance. So just as the government almost always wins under rational basis review, under this kind of review called strict scrutiny, the government almost always loses. Now, I assume there are a bunch of law students here, so this was the unstated premise of my discussion about race and gender. The court had recognized that race is presumptively an unconstitutional classification and does subject racially based classifications to strict scrutiny. The fight that we just about won in 1997 is to have gender treated almost as presumptively, unconstitutionally, a classification as race. But other types of classifications, including age, and including sexual orientation, by the way, Supreme Court and other courts have refused to say that it will allow government, in effect, to draw lines on the basis of lesbian and gay sexuality. All kinds of other classifications that many of us think should trigger a more serious constitutional review. When people ask me about whether you should have rights if you're a minor, I like to go back to the text of the Constitution, which is something that judicial conservatives are fond of doing. There is no age limit in the Bill of Rights.
But there are age limits in other provisions in the Constitution, such as how old you have to be to run for office. And to me, that creates a presumption that there is no automatic age cutoff for the exercise of rights. And in fact, the United States Supreme Court, in some context, has recognized that. We have been very aggressive in fighting for reproductive freedom of young women. And although the court hasn't gone quite as far as we would like, it's come quite far. About 25 years ago, in an opinion by Justice Stevens, he said, in which he upheld the rights of minors to have abortions even when their parents weren't consenting, and even said that they shouldn't be forced to even notify their parents, Justice Stevens made a general statement. He said, constitutional rights do not magically spring into being only when someone happens to attain the state-defined age of majority. So there are areas where we can win. I think if you're talking about anything to do with a substance, forget it. And part of the war on drugs is the war on alcohol. But if you're talking about freedom of speech, we are still, you know, the vegan case aside, fortunately that was an aberration, we are still able to win many free speech cases for people as young as 11 and 12 years old. For those of you who don't read Teen People magazine, I confess I never even heard of Teen People magazine. This was the February issue, has a cover story on teens who are standing up for their rights in high schools all over the country. It was not an article about the ACLU, but I'm happy to say every single one of these instances, the student went to the local ACLU and in every single instance was able to challenge successfully schools cracking down or other government officials cracking down on their rights.
Ms. Johnson, thank you for your remarks. I wanted to ask you about the lawsuit filed by the ACLU against an Ohio school district that chose to give students the days off for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Subsequently, the school district rescinded its policy of giving those days off. Why did the ACLU object to those holidays but not to Good Friday and Christmas, also days off in the school district? And do you think that this sort of litigation strategy creates a system where majority religions are allowed to have their holidays off but not minority religions?
I'm sure that long ago we did challenge Good Friday and did challenge Christmas and, you know, lost those cases. And I really commend to your attention materials that you can find on the ACLU of Ohio website about the case. I found them very persuasive, and I'm not going to remember the details now, but basically the school itself had adopted a religiously neutral policy. And here just a little introduction to constitutional law for those of you who may not have studied this. Essentially, for a law that involves religion or government policy that involves religion to be constitutional, you have to show that it has a secular purpose and that its primary effect is also secular in nature rather than religious. So here the school said, we have a policy not of singling out Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Christmas for that matter, but we will say that if our attendance records show that there is enough disruption to the school because there is an absenteeism of X, and they have either a numerical amount or a percentage amount, counting both students and faculty members, then we're going to cancel school for those days. We'll treat it as a holiday because the secular purpose of having education go forward is going to be so disrupted by that high a percentage or that high a number of people being absent. As it happened, Chris and we accepted that policy. That was a neutral approach. And we also, although I think we accepted it because we knew we would lose in court on the second aspect, I think one could still argue that, for example, to close a public school on Good Friday is going to have an effect which is primarily religious. That is a completely religious holiday, unlike Christmas, where the courts have said, for better or worse, if I was a devout Christian, I would be very offended by this. And I know devout Christians, including Harry Blackmun, then on the Supreme Court, wrote an opinion saying this. You know, the court, in order to allow Christmas be treated as a secular holiday, has had to emphasize the secular aspects of it, that it's a commercial holiday, that it's part of the winter holiday season. But in fact, many people do see Christmas that way. I know Jewish people who celebrate it from that perspective. I don't think you can say that about Good Friday.
But anyway, we had lost that battle. What happened in this school outside of Cleveland, I believe, or inside of Cleveland, was that the school violated its own standards. The number of people who were, in fact, absent for those high holidays was lower than the standard they had set out. So they had said, here are these neutral criteria, not preferring a particular religion. And by the way, I assume there was, if not a majority, a healthy plurality of Jews at that school. And our clients, by the way, you know, I have to point out, we always have clients in these cases. It's not the ACLU at some troublemaking agency descending upon a school district, as many people seem to feel, but we are, people call us who are very upset and feel that their rights are being violated. And our clients were some minority religions, including some Eastern religions, to the best of my recollection, who really felt that Judaism was being preferred because the school's own policy was being violated in order for those holidays to be celebrated. I never followed the outcome of the case. It seemed to me that one thing that the school could do, although it might look a little bit manipulative after the fact, would be to alter the absenteeism. If they could make a case that the number that left anyway, even though it was smaller than the original guidelines, still was high enough that it was creating a disruption.
Hi. This spring, the law school, I think for the first time, is offering a course in animal law. I know...
Is that being taught by an adjunct or by...
It's by a visiting professor. Mm-hmm. Your credo at the beginning didn't seem to extend Aegis, the ACLU, to animals.
Right.
Is this at all the area that the organization is offering?
No, as my assistants would say, GMTA, Great Minds Think Alike. Well, that sounds immodest. So I was thinking this myself. I heard a report on National Public Radio recently. They were interviewing somebody who was an expert in animal rights. Maybe it's even the person who's going to be teaching here, because it sounds familiar that people is going to be visiting. And he was saying that to simply focus on human beings is, you know, speciesist and shows the same blinders that I think it's so important to have a sense of historical humility because one of the things that we've learned and one of my friends who wrote a history of the ACLU says, you know, George Bush in 1988 accused the ACLU of being outside of the mainstream. We often get that accusation. He said, we're never outside the mainstream, we're just ahead of the mainstream. And, you know, case after case that now is seen as being so uncontroversial, of course that's the right position. At the time that it was being fought, you were a radical or a communist or an extremist or, you know, choose your unfavorite adjective. You know, one example being the defense of the rights of Japanese Americans who were interned in concentration camps, 110,000, during World War II, just on a racial basis. We were attacked as being, you know, undermining the national security of the United States for suggesting that they shouldn't have been incarcerated that way. And then the ultimate irony was to have that great conservative Ronald Reagan in the 1980s issuing an apology. So it could well be that, you know, sometime in the future people will look back and say how benighted that it took the ACLU until 2000 and something to see that they should extend their mandate to animals. Other animals, I should say, right? So I've just started to think about it. I have no idea whether others in the organization are, but what we do, we have, it's a constant opportunity to engage in intellectual activities. If you wanted to write me a letter or he wanted to write me a letter, I would bring it to the attention of our executive committee and they may decide to appoint a policy making committee to investigate the issue. But we could also decide that this is a very important issue, but it's just not part of our mandate. Let another organization take care of it. I've recently found out that a very, very active lawyer for the ACLU, in fact, years ago, he had argued before the Supreme Court the case of Loving versus Virginia, in which in 1967 the court finally struck down miscegenation laws. To me, that's shockingly recently. I know it's a long time ago for you, too, but he is now a full-time lawyer for PETA. You might really have a sympathetic audience, and I think it's something worth considering.
I'm interested in how, a process question for you, I'm interested in how the ACLU comes to its positions on these most contentious issues of
right.
the day. I can imagine as an organization, there are certain principles mm-hmm. that we need to adhere to,
mm-hmm.
and so across time, your mm-hmm. positions are uniform. But as an individual,
right.
Our human intuitions tend to be much more complex.
Right.
And so how do you reconcile your own perspective on issues when they differ from what the ACLU lands on?
Well, thank you. Excellent questions. First of all, the vast, vast, vast majority of what we do, there is no contention about, and I suspect that would be true not only for us, but for the vast majority of people in this room and around the country. The vast majority of our efforts go into actually enforcing for actual people all over the country rights that clearly exist as a matter of law. John just told me a story, I hope you don't mind, as we were driving from the airport, how he was teaching in Kentucky in 1996 in a public high school, and found out that the biology teacher, or one of the teachers in the school, had arranged to have the pages of the biology textbook that dealt with evolution being taped up. And I said, I hope you called the local ACLU, don't want to put him on the spot. So stuff like that happens all over the country every day. And if you don't mind my digressing, because I think it's so fascinating, when I first became head of this organization, I remember one of the first people I talked to happened to be our staff lawyer in Pennsylvania, and he showed me the form letter that he uses for most of his cases. It's got, you fill in the name of the government official that you're addressing it to, then it says Ray, and you fill in the incident that's being complained about. Dear Mr. or Ms., please be advised that the foregoing violates the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. See attached. Attached is a copy of the First Amendment because many of And so the vast, vast, vast majority of what we do is not contentious, and I really want to say those are easy cases to win. You can win them as a young lawyer, straight out of law school. You're not going to make new precedent, but you really are going to make all the difference in the world between the Bill of Rights existing in theory and existing in reality in entire school districts and entire towns, sometimes in larger communities. Now, there are always contentious issues. Where even people who are fully committed to civil liberties can disagree with each other. I talked about the double jeopardy issue. So let me tell you, in 1992, after the acquittal in the first prosecution of the police officers in the Rodney King case, there was a very strong effort on the part of some members of our national board, which sets policy at the national level of the organization, to craft, not to buy into this wholesale dual sovereignty fiction that the Supreme Court has created, but to craft a narrow exception for a particular kind of crime that the federal government, given the history of racial discrimination and segregation, the unique role that the federal government consistently had played, the oppressive role that states and local governments consistently had played throughout our history, to craft a narrow exception for civil rights prosecution by the federal government against local law enforcement authorities. That came within a hair's breadth of being passed. It did not ultimately pass. When I say hair's breadth, the board was closely split on that. And there are other instances where we've had debates. Martha mentioned very ferocious debates. Martha mentioned hate crimes. If what you're talking about is, I don't like the term hate crime because the way it sounds as if you're punishing a thought, which is something we would clearly oppose. We've always opposed censorship of hate speech, including leading the charge against the wave of campus hate speech codes that we started to see about 10 years ago. But when what you're talking about is an enhanced penalty for something that is already a crime, when the victim is intentionally selected on the basis of racial or other kinds of discrimination, we ultimately decided after long debates with a fairly closely divided vote that at least in principle, not every enforcement of every such law would violate First Amendment rights, although we recognize a great danger that they, in particular prosecutions, could, in fact,
punish somebody for a thought or an expression or an association, and so we would monitor the enforcement of these laws to look at what evidence was being introduced. So I've already, by giving you two examples, told you what the process is. At the national level of the organization, we have a national board of directors that engages in these debates with very substantive policy positions and position papers. It's almost, you know, it has all of the intellectual excitement of a debating society or an academic undertaking, but knowing that it's going to have real-world implications. One of my law school classmates, Steve Shapiro, Harvard Law School class of 75, is the legal director, national legal director of the ACLU. He has worked for the ACLU full-time since getting out of law school. And I heard him speaking at a national gathering recently, and he made a point that I realized is also something that's a great joy about this kind of work, talking about the constant intellectual challenge. I mean, it's not only that you have the joy of being in there in the trenches and making a difference in the real world, but the ideas that are involved are also amazingly challenging and complex. And I think that's why we are able to enlist so many outstanding academics to write our briefs with us, to argue our cases. Larry Tribe of your faculty, for example, has authored numerous ACLU briefs and done the oral arguments on ACLU cases in the Supreme Court. And then the question was, for me personally, is it trying to sometimes disagree? Not really, because there is always enough of the two arguments that I presented to you so far. I ultimately took a position and exercised my right to vote as a member of the board. But the arguments on both sides were respectable enough and plausible enough that I could have made them, and I don't think it's worth going to the mat over, you know, I never felt, I guess there is one instance where I felt very strongly that my board made a mistake and I was in the position of publicly having to defend it, but there were still enough strong arguments in favor of what they did that I was able to say, look, reasonable people and reasonable civil libertarians can disagree about this. I'm not embarrassed about that. Why should I be? As the head of an organization that does more to defend the right of dissent, it would be absurd if we didn't tolerate dissent within our own ranks. I'm sorry, I just realized all the people who've asked questions so far are guys, so I'm going to get you.
You've been talking a little bit about defending young adults, mm-hmm. and children. I'm wondering if the ACLU has become involved at all in Proposition 21 in California,
yeah.
the girls' proposition, which would basically treat children as adults and build a home with everyone. It has a lot of racial issues attached to it, too.
Oh, of course, everything with the criminal justice system does. Yes, in Ray Galt, the first case in which the Supreme Court had recognized that due process rights extend to those who are involved in the so-called juvenile justice system, I guess now we call it juvenile injustice system, that was an ACLU case that was argued in the United States Supreme Court by my predecessor, Norman Dorson, who's a professor at NYU Law School. And we continue to be very concerned about not only rights of young people, but also rights of people accused of crime. And those two obviously come together. In terms of public advocacy, we recognize that sometimes the ACLU is not the most effective public voice to be prominently out there on a particular issue. So this is one, because the ACLU is known as, oh, you always defend criminals and ho-hum. In fact, I've seen some graffiti of what our acronym can stand for, all criminals love us. You know, some of those criminals are accused criminals are people like Oliver North and Ed Meese, who don't understand the need for people who are accused of crime to have rights until they're accused of crime themselves. But what I think is very interesting that we've been able to do in this area is to get into coalitions, and it's happened in California as it's happened at the national level, with not the usual suspects. I mean, probation officers, prison guards, people who are deep, prosecutors, police officers, people who are deeply involved in the criminal justice system, who from their perspective, not because they're civil libertarians, but because they care about law and order, saying this is not the right way to go in terms of reducing crime. And, you know, in addition to the just heartbreaking and terrifying statistics about how vulnerable young people are in the adult prison system, how prone they are, of course, to rape and abuse, but also to suicide. The statistics about recidivism are completely counter indicated to this proposition. If all you cared about was protecting the community, you said, the hell with, forgive me, the hell with those criminals and racial minorities and scum of the earth. You know, I just care about protecting the safety for fine, upstanding middle Americans. You should still vote against this proposition, because everybody who has anything, any knowledge of the criminal justice system agrees that youth who are treated as adults and incarcerated with adults are infinitely more likely to become recidivists, to prey upon society, rather than to be integrated. Now, it's probably going to pass, right? That's what I read. And the question is, can there be a constitutional challenge to it? In some ways, it goes back to some of the issues you raised about what rights young people have. It will be a tough road to hoe. In terms of all constitutional protections that apply to the criminal justice system, the Supreme Court has been very, very much against those for a long time now. I talked about the court providing safety net on some issues. Unfortunately, on 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th Amendment rights, it hasn't been providing much of a safety net.
Okay. How does the ACLU decide what rights are actual constitutional rights or liberties? For instance, you talk about equal protection and women. Do you look at the intent, if they're just words of it, or do you try to extend it to encompass as many Americans as you can?
Right. These are all such good questions, and it's really, I don't want to give too long-winded an answer, but they can't be answered simply. And I would say on your question and on your question and some of the others, I've actually written law review articles that go into depth, and I'd be happy to give you those citations. But first and foremost, we are the American Civil Liberties Union. We are not the American Constitutional Law Union. For those who have studied constitutional law, you know the Constitution only protects individuals against state action, government violations of rights. And we've always had the view that other entities in our society, other than government, are capable of violating what we think should be fundamental civil liberties. So, for example, we have always lobbied very much in favor of every civil rights law prohibiting discrimination in the private sector. And as you know, we needed those laws precisely because the Constitution did not prohibit any private employers or universities, et cetera, from discriminating on the basis of race, religion. So for us, it's a somewhat different question than what does the Constitution mean. For us, the Constitution is a tool, but only is potentially a tool, but not the only potential tool that we would use when it applies to protect what we independently consider to be a civil liberty. I often get, I'm a long time to be speaking to an audience without a question about the Second Amendment. I'm often asked, what does the ACLU do about the Second Amendment? For us, the issue is not what does it say about what kind of gun regulations are constitutional. For us, the question is, should there be a fundamental civil liberty to unregulated private gun ownership? And if we answered that question yes, which we have not, then we would have to look beyond the Second Amendment, because the Supreme Court hasn't interpreted the Second Amendment as providing that kind of protection. The short answer is that we try to do essentially what the U.S. Supreme Court does when it asks whether there is a fundamental right, and we have evolved over history as the U.S. Supreme Court itself has. I think it was sometime in the 1960s that we decided that there should be a fundamental right of reproductive freedom before the Supreme Court, but certainly long after we had existed.
Yeah, you talked earlier about the ACLU and narrow votes on some things, and I was involved with the clean elections reform here in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and you might know the Massachusetts ACLU voted very narrowly to mm-hmm. not to oppose the clean elections initiative, mm-hmm. but I know the ACLU has opposed them in some other states. So I guess my questions were, first of all, how does the ACLU deal with things like campaign finance reform? Mm-hmm. And I guess the broader question is, how do they deal with conflicting mm-hmm. constitutional interests possibly? I mean, some people might view that just as a free speech issue. Some mm-hmm. might view it as conflicting interests at stake. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, should the ACLU sort of balance those and mm-hmm. decide, well, this one is more important than that mm-hmm. one, so we'll fall down on mm-hmm. that side, or mm-hmm. should it just stay neutral if that's
right.
the case?
Well, you raise another process issue, and that is that we have not, I said national board decides national policies, but we have state-based affiliates with their own boards who decide the policy for the states. Again, being an anarchic civil liberties organization, our motto within the organization is unity without absolute uniformity. So sometimes there are differences between affiliates and the national or among affiliates. Again, I don't consider that particularly embarrassing as long as there is a solid civil liberties foundation for coming out either way. In terms of campaign finance reform, I understand there was a whole program about that at Harvard Law School last week, and the ACLU position was very well represented, I'm told. And you can find, I think, the best statement of our position that would be the easiest for you to find is the brief that we filed in Nixon versus Shrink Missouri PAC, which is a case that the Supreme Court has already decided. You can find that on the ACLU website at aclu.org. But essentially, Buckley versus Vallejo was our case, which the court got partly right and partly wrong. Our view is that, and I guess our view is now being taken most stridently by Justices Kennedy and Scalia and Thomas, that if there is any expression in democratic society that is at the core of the First Amendment, it has to be expression related to the electoral process, either on issues advocacy or advocacy of candidates. And money is not speech, to use that over-hackneyed phrase, but money certainly is essential in an era where we're so dependent on mass media to spread your message far and wide. Now, having said that, the countervailing, or not necessarily countervailing, but the other constitutional civil liberties interest that is clearly at stake is equality of access to the political process. And that's certainly something that we care about deeply. And in our briefs and other position statements on campaign finance reform, we always say that we oppose restrictions on expenditures and contributions not only because of violating this core set of First Amendment rights, but also because it is a demonstrably ineffective, perhaps even counterproductive way to advance the assertively countervailing concern. If you look at what's happened with this regime of federal political speech police since the 1970s, the two-party system has become much more entrenched. It is much more difficult for an insurgent candidate to gain a foothold. People are being alienated from the political process, and I find it kind of ironic that often if you look at the criminal justice system, for example, or social welfare programs, people will say, oh, you know, liberals just want to keep spending, throwing money at a problem. Oh, here it seems that, I don't know, this odd mix of liberals and conservatives says, well, you know, spending restrictions haven't worked and contribution restrictions haven't worked, so let's just try more of them. It seems to me that it's demonstrably bankrupt and that the way to go is what we always have advocated and recently have begun to do so somewhat more aggressively, and that is complete public financing of all campaigns, not only for Republicans and Democrats, but for anybody who can get ballot access. And it's amazing. If you look at the numbers, even including, you know, every single candidate for everything from Dodd-Frister up to President of the United States, it's a shockingly trivial amount, something like $1 for every taxpayer. And we think that there is no better expenditure that can be made in a democracy. Interestingly enough, some campaign reform organizations recently have come on board with the ACLU. Now, they don't care about free speech. Their only concern is, I'm not saying they don't care, but that's not their primary issue. Their concern is, how are we finally going to get some meaningful, effective reform? And from that very different perspective, they've come to exactly the same conclusion. On the plane flying up here from New York, I saw my friend and debate adversary, Arianna Huffington, who was going to be speaking at the Kennedy School. She and I were just on Politically Incorrect together on Thursday. Her new book, it's amazing to me, is that she's completely advocating public financing. So I think that is an idea that is starting to gain some momentum. And sorry, I'm trying for shorter answers.
Since we're on our second round of questions, it might be a good time to close out the formal session.
I wouldn't have called on him if I had known he was going to do that.
Yes. As long as there are questions, so some of you might want to leave, but anyone that has questions, feel free to come down, and I think you'd be willing to take questions.
I sure will. Thank you very much.